Good morning and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. Jump in Tucson's Monday theme is Wonder, where we celebrate the good things going on at the U of A, including student projects and learning, student outcomes, as well as top-level performances by artists and athletes, and especially top-tier research going on with faculty and scientists at the University of Arizona. We have one of those researchers and scientists with us this morning. We have Beth Tellman. She is an assistant professor in the School of Geography and Development and Environment at the College of Social and Behavior Sciences at the University of Arizona. Good morning, Beth.
Hi, good morning to you.
Thank you for being with us this morning. If you could just see it, we get it started to know a little bit more about Beth Tellman. Tell us a little bit about your own educational journey and how you got to the University of Arizona.
Yeah, so I actually did my PhD at Arizona State University in the School of Geographical Sciences and Urban Planning there. And I really fell in love with the Southwest. And I always thought, gee, if I could really get a job back in the Southwest at a university, wouldn't that be great? And gosh, you know, I really love Tucson. Hopefully I can get a job there one day. And lo and behold, in the first year of my postdoc, which I did at the Earth and Engineering Sciences Department at Columbia University in New York, a job opened up in the geography department here at U of A. So I eagerly applied and eagerly accepted the position when I was offered. So really happy to be back in the Southwest, which I think is a really unique and important place to be studying climate change and human-environment interactions, which is what I focus on.
And you're an assistant professor, which means you do some teaching and you do research as well. So what kind of classes do you teach and what kind of students do you have, undergraduates, doctoral students? Who are you mentoring?
Yeah, so I do a mix. My undergraduate teaching, I teach remote sensing, so how to analyze satellite imagery. I teach an undergraduate class called Water, Environment, and Society, where we look at human-environment relationships of water in the Southwest and around the world. And I also teach graduate seminars on human-environment geography. I run a somewhat medium-sized to large lab of about 10 people, both master's, PhD students, and postdoc students. My lab is called the Social Pixel Lab because we mix social science with pixel data from satellite imagery as the focus of our research.
And so we're going to talk today about floods and water coming down. I was just talking with Greg Gerringer, who is the program director at Bustos Medias here, and he was indicating that one of the on-air talent has a house in near La Cholla and Rudisill, I think it was, is where it was located. And in 1 hour, they got 3.5 inches of rain in 1 hour. The amount of rain that they would typically get in a summertime monsoon season, they got in 1 hour, 3.5 inches in 1 hour. And that was about, in midsummer. So predicting how floods are going to happen is not what you do, because you just cannot predict what's going to happen per se, unless you know that a dam is going to break and the water is going to come flooding through. There are maybe some predictors, but you never know when and you never know how much. So you're working on floods, but you're not working on the prediction of floods. You're working on the data that comes from after the occurrence and knowing where the floods are. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we use satellite imagery mainly to look at where water went after the flood happened. Although that can be really helpful in helping us prepare for the next event, and you can use it in a predictive capacity in some way, which I can get into a little bit later.
So you basically use machine learning models and data sets for flood monitoring. So this gathering of data and bringing it together and looking at that data and understanding from the data that you collect and data that other people collect, putting that together to see what the flood exposure might be and understand those interactions between the land that is around these floods and climate change and floods. It all kind of goes together in one big giant hopper, correct?
Yes.
So could you share a little bit about your focus? You have a fairly new NASA funded grant that has applied aspects within NASA to work with a visible infrared imaging radiometer suite. Okay, so VIIRS, so visible infrared imaging radiometer suite. Can you tell a little bit about what you do with that that information and that data?
Yeah, so VIIRS, or VIRS as everyone calls it at NASA, is really the continuation of a long-standing mission of called MODIS at NASA, so that really started in the 2000s. So this these are sensors that take images of the entire planet every single day. So you could really track change over time, and something that's moving really quickly, such as water during a flood. And so we use data from that sensor. It has many, many bands, which means that it's collecting information, not just in the visible spectrum, so like what you see in a camera, but in energy much outside what your visible eye can see, and both longer and shorter wavelengths. So near infrared, which maybe some people are familiar with if they do sort of high-end photography, but even longer wavelengths of light, middle infrared, thermal, and other kind of another wavelengths. And it's really useful to be able to use all of that different data to identify features on the surface of the Earth. And we use especially the middle infrared and shortwave infrared spectrum to identify water. The VIIRS satellite has really great bands in that spectrum. So we're helping NASA develop an algorithm that's better than one that they currently have, and so that they can take up machine learning to have a better flood monitoring system with this satellite that anyone can use around the world for free and download imagery that identifies automatically the water that was in that image. And that's really useful for governments, first responders, insurance companies, and a whole suite of different people.
I would think that would even help farmers and agricultural businesses when they know where the water is and where it has been and where it's resting, and getting that visual on that is also probably important for farming. It's interesting that you're working with NASA. I use an urban myth that's saying that every NASA program that has gone to space since its inception has involved somebody from the University of Arizona, either leading the team or being on the team that, you know, evidence going to Bennu recently, and that was basically a U of A project in concert with NASA. So it's great that you're working with NASA in a unique and different way, using the satellite imagery in a unique and different way, other than just sending out spacecraft out into space and looking at space. You're looking at the Earth. So you're turning around and looking backwards to the Earth.
Yeah, most people, when they think of NASA, they think about space and all of the instruments that are looking out away from the Earth. But NASA actually has an incredible amount of data and satellites pointed at the Earth, telling us about the planet every day. And that kind of data is used, little do people know, in their day-to-day lives to make weather predictions, to understand how much it's raining. A lot of what you see on the weather forecast every day is powered by NASA data and satellites that are looking at our Earth.
Great. When we come back, we'll talk about flood data and map making and what your little award was that you got recently. So you're listening to Jump in Tucson. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Ed Ackerley, your host. We're talking with Beth Tellman. She's an assistant professor in the School of Geography, Development, and Environment in the College of Social and Behavior Sciences. And on Mondays, we talk about wonder, the good things that are going on at the University of Arizona. And Beth Tellman's going to be talking about mapping floods and so forth. First, I wanted to congratulate you on your National Science Foundation Career Award involving tracking urban development and flooding. Can you share some information about that award and what you received?
Yeah. Thanks so much. So this is an award that you can get as an early career scientist, one of the ones you really want to try and get as an early career scientist from the National Science Foundation. And what I will be doing in this award over 5 years is first generating a really large database of different floods that have happened in the United States with really high resolution satellite imagery. And in particular, I want to track how flooding is changing in places that are urbanizing and developing over time. And that's really interesting to look at, because every time cities grow or housing development occurs in a floodplain, often real estate developers are interested in increasing the value of that property, or they might not want to purchase insurance. In the United States, you're required to purchase insurance on a mortgage that's in a floodplain. But as a developer, you could install a flood mitigation project and divert floodwater away from your development and have FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Authority, redraw the flood map and so that those homes are outside of the floodplain. And so what I want to see is, when that happens, did it really work? When the next flood comes, did whatever the developers built actually prevent flooding for their development? And did it affect anybody else? Because sometimes when we build levees or walls or install culverts, we may be removing floodwater away from our property by exporting it to somebody else downstream. So I want to track where the water is moving when we are building cities and moving water around. And I'll be using satellite imagery to do that.
I think a good example of that might be in Tucson. We have ditches or washes, we call them arroyos, which are basically dry until the monsoons hit, and then they go bank to bank. A lot of the washes and arroyos in Tucson have been cemented wall to wall, top to bottom, and when the water gets into them, it shoots it straight down the arroyo, whereas it might meander down the arroyo where there's natural vegetation and things that would be stopping it. But when we mitigate the flooding by putting up the cement walls and so forth, it kind of acts like a chute and sends the water down the arroyo. And so your question is, how does that affect the people downwash or downriver from that? What are they going to see? Because we've mitigated the flood in one area, what is the response in another area?
Right, exactly. And what I'm interested to see too is, what are the social implications of that? A lot of times, the people who have the money to be installing flood mitigation infrastructure tend to be wealthier, wider communities. And so sometimes what I'm wondering is, are they shunting their water downstream to poor communities of color? We know in the US that poor communities of color already experience much higher flood vulnerability than everybody else. And I'm wondering if this might be one of the reasons why.
Interesting. You know, how can mapping floods help policymakers, legislators, and so forth, but also even insurance companies when they're, and in the federal government, FEMA and so forth, all of this infrastructure that's around flooding, how can your mapping help these policymakers and I use that term in two ways, policymakers legislatively and policymakers insurance policies, and those policymakers, how can your mapping help them with information to come up with the right decisions on what to do in a certain particular area?
Well, on the insurance side, satellite data can show you where water was, and it can help make flood models more accurate. And you can even use satellite data to write a unique type of insurance policy that's only based on satellites. Parametric or index insurance, which is different than traditional insurance, where you have someone come to your house and assess the damage, and maybe you go to court and fight about how much the damage really was and then get a payout. Parametric or index insurance is when you automatically get a payout based on data. So imagine cutting out sort of the whole middleman of that process and having an automatic payment based on a pre-specified contract. That can make insurance much cheaper. And so I actually started a company about a decade ago called Floodbase that produces data and works with insurance companies to sell those new types of policies. And that would enable flood insurance to exist where it cannot exist today because it's too expensive or we don't have the data to write those policies. So we work all around the world making flood insurance possible where it wasn't before.
Very interesting. So we're talking with Dr. Beth Tillman. She is an assistant professor in the School of Geography, Development, and Environment at the College of Social and Behavior Sciences. And we're talking about mapping floods, not only in America, but around the world. So you don't predict floods. You're not in the business of saying this is where the next flood is going to happen per se. What you're trying to do is map events that have already occurred and what are the implications of the number of floods that would happen in an area and so forth. So how has that model that you've put together, this data, how has it helped? Even though you're not in the science of prediction per se, how does it help us maybe look to the future and see if there is some predictive value in the data that you're sharing?
Well, first, we help make predictive models better. So often modelers will use our data to try to see where their model's predicting floods incorrectly, to see, use a snapshot to see where did the water go. Okay, we got that part right. Let's adjust this parameter. Oh, not enough water there. Let's move this over here to try to make your model more accurately match what has been observed in the past. We're also starting to use machine learning to help make predictive models better. So we had a paper that just got accepted last week in a journal called Geophysical Research Letters, where it's National Water Model on satellite data actually is better, produces better flood maps in predictive mode than the traditional physically based hydrology model that the government had been using. So we're just seeing that this type of data really can help the physically based models perform better and use machine learning to take advantage of understanding those patterns that we're capturing every day of how water really moves around the earth.
And you're a scientist, and but you're also in the College of Social and Behavior Sciences, and obviously there are some social issues and implications, as you said, moving from more affluent areas into less affluent areas, and what is the relationship between those, and who's affected by that, and who takes the hit on the flood mitigation and so forth. So there are some social issues here, and one of those, which unfortunately has become a political issue, is the concept of climate change and how perhaps in the last few years or decades, we've seen more flooding because of the violent weather that we've experienced. Even in our, we just had one of the university professors who was in the prediction of hurricanes, and that this is going to be the strongest hurricane summer ever, probably. And we've already had the very first hurricane that was the earliest ever in the hurricane season. And so. How does climate change, how is it affected by your prediction, or not your predictions, but the data sets that you're putting forward and the models that you would put forth to help with those predictions? What is with warmer climates and hotter summers, what does that mean for water and the atmosphere to hold the water and the flooding that would come from that?
Yeah, so maybe you've heard this kind of rule before, but for every degree Celsius of warming we have, the atmosphere can hold 7% more water. So that might not seem like a lot. Oh, it's just 7%. But actually, that extra 7% can be the difference between a flood being not damaging and a flood being totally catastrophic. Our infrastructure is built typically to a certain specification, maybe the 50 or 100 year flood. But when the atmosphere is raining more than it ever physically has been able to do before, water's going to overflow those systems. So that 7% really is what can make the difference. And really large hurricane systems like Hurricane Harvey in Houston, the amount of rainfall that drops is really affected by warming in the atmosphere just because of how much water can be held. So we're seeing larger floods happen more frequently, all the time now.
And so, I live on a wash or an arroyo, is right behind my back wall of my house, and we have seen, and I've been there 35 years, and we have seen more water coming down that arroyo than ever before. And a couple of occasions recently, it's bank to bank, and it's full. And where it used to just kind of trickle down and kind of run off from the streets and so forth would kind of go through there. Now we're seeing it. So it does have implications for individuals. Global warming is real in terms of flooding and the water that comes from that. So very interesting research that you have on flooding. I want to thank you today, Dr. Beth Tellman, Assistant Professor of the School of Geography, Development, and Environment at the University of Arizona. And once again, congratulations to you on your National Science Foundation Career Award, tracking urban development and flooding. That's fantastic that you get that honor and early in your career. And that's great. And we look forward to some exciting things from you as you map flooding across the world.
Thanks so much for having me.
So we're looking forward to, if people wanted to learn more about what your work and so forth, where would they go? What website would they go to see what you're doing?
Yeah, so you could check out my lab's website. And just get the right
And the
link up here. It's Beth hyphen Tellman, tellman.github.io. That's the
Great.
Social Pixel Lab website.
Great.
You'll find it if you Google my name.
And you'd get that information on what you're working on and what the the award was and what you're doing and your and the papers that you just mentioned a paper that's on there as well. So thank you so much, Dr. Tellman. We appreciate you being here on Jump in Tucson. This is KVOI, 10:30 a.m. The Voice, Tucson's only live local news and talk. And this is Jump in Tucson, the Wonder Edition. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. With me co-hosting today is my good friend, Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley. Glad to be here.
You've had a long career in law enforcement over the years as a TPD officer and then police chief in South Tucson. So you're pretty up on safety and security, right? It's an important part of what we do as a society.
Yes, and then I did 10 years work in security for the Sunnyside Unified School District after I left law enforcement.
Yeah, so which was still kind of a law enforcement job.
Yes.
So safety on campus is really important, and that's one of the things we're going to talk about today on Jump in Tucson. This is the Wonder Series where we talk about the good things that are happening at the University of Arizona. And with us this morning, again, welcome back to someone who's got a lot of experience in campus safety, Steve Patterson. Welcome back.
Thank you, Ed.
So your title is, you're the director of the Office of Public Safety, Vice President of Security, I guess is what you are, yeah?
Yeah, Vice President and Chief Safety Officer for the University of Arizona is the official title.
Yeah, and your journey is, you were with the FBI, that's probably the biggest legacy you have was many, many years with the FBI, right?
Yes, I retired almost 2 years ago to the day from the FBI. I retired as the Assistant Special Agent in Charge here in the Tucson office.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've had you on Jump in Tucson before, and you've shared with us the vision for what is happening at the University of Arizona. But recently, within the last few weeks and months, there's been some important security issues, specifically over the last couple of years since you've joined the team. And the university has responded with some powerful changes to make sure that the safety of students, faculty, staff, and the community is important. Do you just want to go over some of those things? We'll talk about the PACS report in a little bit, but can you just share some of those initiatives that you've instigated in trying to bring the community together and focus on safety?
Right. Yeah. We're really trying to focus on a whole of community approach, but to break it down in the simplest terms, we're really focusing on community involvement, meaning engagement, media awareness, similar to what I'm doing now, prevention, which is the training, resources available, physical updates that we've made. You've heard us discuss putting locks on doors, message boards, stuff like that. And then obviously the response is how do we respond to a situation, a crisis of any sort. And that's making sure that UAPD has proper number of officers. We've completely revitalized our threat assessment and management team, our TAMPT team. Mm-hmm. Dr. Jessica Semin is in charge of that and working on really at this point creating it's the prevention and the awareness piece that we're really trying to focus on. There's always going to be the physical updates that we do, and we're looking at additional security cameras throughout campus. We hope to be able to put a handful of them on top of some of the blue light phones that you see throughout campus. But a lot of it is the education piece. We talk about this a lot in that the university, unlike most other large organization, loses, 10 to 20% of their population every single May. Mm-hmm. And every single August, we gain new people. So trying to ensure that our incoming students, our incoming faculty, our incoming staff are aware of the resources that are available to them. In the coming weeks, starting basically next week, I'm doing presentations, part of open forums, as parents and students are starting to come to campus here on the resources that are available to them, what UAlert is, what the blue light phones are, what Cleary is, all those type of things is all part of an educational piece that we're working through over the next few weeks.
I can say, as a faculty member at the college for well over three decades now, in the last year and a half or 2 years, this is the most intensive training and a focus on safety that I've seen in those 30 years. And, you know, we used to go into the classroom with, I have no training, just go in and teach and leave. And if something did happen, we would have no idea what to do. At least back then, I would have had no, just common sense, obviously, but wouldn't know what to do. So it is interesting how the awareness factor in this society that we're in. And of course, the students have their phones with them full time, so they're up to the second with anything that's happening anywhere in the city of Tucson. They know what's going on. So sometimes they know more than I do in terms of the situations themselves. So that community awareness is really important. But also, I'll just say that the training is important. So I've had some training now that I didn't have before. And I think that important, we were talking earlier about faculty being leading those classrooms, and they need to know exactly what they need to do. You know, you never know what to do in a situation until you get into it, but at least with the training, you have some resources to fall back on.
Yeah, we've updated our active shooter video, which is required for all faculty and staff. Dr. Jessica Semin is in the process right now of building out a training curriculum for faculty, staff, and students on, you know, conflict resolutions, threat awareness, you know, and trying to be able to make a, you know, be able to determine where you can diffuse situations, where maybe you need to get our threat assessment team involved, where you need to maybe even get, you know, UAPD law enforcement involved.
Right. You know, across the United States, there's been a lot of unrest on college campuses over the last several months. And, you know, maybe that'll kick back in a little bit when students start coming back in August, all across the country, not just at the University of Arizona. But can you share a little bit about how you all responded to in the spring? Sixto and I have talked about what a great response there was from the UAPD and from your office and to kind of tamp down the temperature. What did you do to make that a meaningful and good result, and what will you be doing in the future should something like that, whether it be this issue or some other issue that we don't even know is coming to the fray yet?
Right. I think it's making sure that we have open dialogue. We had talked a few minutes ago about turning the volume down, trying to turn the heat down a little bit, and that's what we're trying to do now. We have, through Chris Olson, who I know you've had on the show, you know, and myself, we have relationships with Tucson Police Department. We have relationships with Pima County Sheriff's Department and DPS. And ultimately, the nights of the protests, we were all working together to try to have as safe as a conclusion as possible. And ultimately, our number one priority is to keep people safe.
Mm-hmm. The way you are the Office of Public Safety, so
exactly, yeah. it speaks for itself, right?
Right.
And the events that occurred, was I happy that everybody just didn't walk away? No, I wasn't. Are there going to be some changes that the police department looks at? Sure. Are there going to be some changes on how we communicate campus use policy with our community? Yes. Right now, over the coming weeks, months, been having regular engagement with members of the student population, student leadership, to try to see if we can't get a better understanding of what our campus use policy is, what you can, what you can't do. And then, you know, what are the repercussions if you don't do these things? And working with the administration to see, you know, are there areas where we should look at, and maybe we should review the policy, maybe we should make some changes in things. But trying to keep that active engagement. I need to be clear, you know, the challenges that the university is dealing with is not new,
right?
And it's certainly not specific and focused strictly on the University of Arizona. I mean, you saw last spring, these events were going on throughout the nation. And unfortunately, they continue in some way, shape, or form. We're just trying to work together.
When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the PACS report and safety survey that you have at the U of A. You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. I'm your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. With me in studio, my co-host, Sixto Molina. Good morning again, Sixto.
Good morning, sir.
You had a long history, as we were talking about, in the law enforcement business. And with us is Steve Patterson, who is in charge of the Office of Public Safety at the University of Arizona. This is the Wonder Series. On Mondays, we talk about the good things going on at the U of A. And both Sixto and I just have to say that you have done an excellent job of managing the safety profile since you got there to U of A. So thank you for your service. Sixto, you were going to ask him a question?
Yes. Steve, you mentioned open line of communication with the event organizers, even if it's a protest. And I think that is very, very important because they need to know what the parameters are, what the rules of engagement are, and what the consequences will be if they don't follow those rules. And equally, you've got to give them some space to honor their freedom of expression. So communication is utmost important.
Yeah, I think knowing what their plan is, hey, we're going to walk down this way, we're going to stop over here, we're going to do this, we're not going to do that, is key. You know, in law enforcement, we don't like surprises. And to be able to make sure everybody understands what they're going to be doing, I spent almost 25 years of my professional life defending the Constitution, defending the rights that we have. And I think it's very important, and I'm very proud of the efforts that the university does to promote everybody's ability to say what they want to say. And I think that we need to continue to do that. We just need to make sure that we're doing it in a manner that doesn't hurt anybody.
Exactly.
You had a big report come out, the PACS report, after the situation a couple of years ago. The president commissioned a commission that came back with 31 recommendations, and not only did you implement those 31, you added on some of other ones. Can you just talk a little bit about how the university has responded to the suggestions in the PACS report, implemented some of those, and are on a trajectory to even add more to make it a safer community?
Yeah, we've treated the PACS report and the recommendations that they made as kind of a benchmark, but we've now, what was originally 30 some odd recommendations, we're up into the hundreds of different action items that we have and we are doing. For the most part, all of the action recommendations on the PACS report have been completed. There are some that are going to be ongoing. But we look at that as just like, I guess, a benchmark or a starting point. Mm-hmm. I appreciate all the work that the PACS team did and really helped us kind of organize our processes on how we're going to make some of these changes. But if we were to, and we've actually talked about doing this in the past, if stack up all the positive changes and the safety related changes we've made, it would be into the hundreds.
We're talking to Steve Patterson, who's the Vice President and Chief Safety Officer at the University of Arizona. And, you know, you did a safety survey that was sent out to faculty and students and staff. And can you talk, obviously the results of that aren't totally out yet, but just the process of going through the safety survey to try and get input from those people that are affected by safety.
Sure. It kind of ties in actually a little bit to the PACS report. As we were going through the different recommendations and doing more, the questions that I started asking is, okay, well, where do we stand with our community? Where does our community think we are when it comes to safety? And that's where the conversation, probably about 9 months ago, let's try to conduct a safety survey, ideally do it annually, have a handful of standardized questions, but really try to look at where we are, because you know, we, in some ways, you can't see the forest for the trees. Is you want to you think you're doing the right thing, but you want to make sure you're reaching out to your community and making sure. So spent a lot of time with a lot of professionals who are experts at writing survey questions. I never knew there was as much detail that was needed on those, but my real desire, the team's desire was, is I wanted to get actionable answers. I didn't want to just ask the question, do you feel safe or do you not feel safe? Because it doesn't give us an opportunity to potentially take action. And keeping in mind what I said earlier is we lose 15 to 20% of our population. So annually, we're going to really have to try to figure out exactly how we are making our stair step to progress, because we have people who are coming from outside. So we're in the process right now of still compiling all the data. We are looking early fall to start providing some of the details of that survey to our community. Looking forward and excited to share that information with everybody. And we hope to be able to take some of that, and we even now are looking at that and seeing, okay, how can we maybe make some adjustments based off of that information?
Well, we'll have you back in the fall to maybe share that data and share some of that information. Sixto, how long does it take us to get from the tailgate areas over to the football stadium when I'm with you and we're walking towards the stadium? It takes us about an hour, right?
A long time.
And the reason is because you stop and talk to every single police officer on campus as we're heading towards you stop, and we have these conversations with and thank them for their service. But that, which I you know, it's kind of silly that I would bring that up, but that's a really important thing, because the police shouldn't be in the background and not part of they need to be in part of the fabric and get to know the students and get to know the faculty and staff and be perceived as being valuable partners in this, and not just someone that you call 911 when some terrible thing happens. So what can students, faculty, staff, and even the community do to create a safer and more inviting campus and environment for everybody on campus to feel safe?
You first hit on it. One of the things that Chief Olson has started is he started a community academy. So this past spring was the first community academy. It's about 10 weeks long, where members of faculty and staff, upwards of about 50, come and for 10 weeks in the evening, one evening a week, they learn about what UAPD does, and really helps our faculty and staff understand what the PD does, but also helps with that engagement piece. So that would be the first thing is I would say, look for those invitations from faculty on the faculty and staff side here really soon. Students, there's going to be a lot of active engagement here in the coming months. The Wildcat Safety Guide within safety.arizona.edu is really important and discusses a lot of different resources that we have available. The two that I want to highlight is the Live Safe application, which you can upload onto your phone. And really what it does is just with a push of a button, you can do a 911 call. You don't even have to dial the three digits. You just push that button. It's kind of a mobile blue light phone, if you will. Mm-hmm. And then the other one is the Safe Ride application. And the details of that are in the Wildcat Safety Guide. There's a service that similar to Uber or Lyft, where you in the surrounding areas around campus, you can get a ride if you need it in the evening.
Well, great. We'll have you back in the fall to talk about the survey and to see what initiatives the Safety Commission and your office are doing for public safety. Sixto, thanks for being with us this morning. Steve Patterson, Vice President and Chief Safety Officer and Chair of the Campus Safety Commission, thank you for all you do. If you'd like to be interviewed on Jump in Tucson on the Friday show about your business or organization, or if you're on campus at the U of A and would like to be on the Monday Wonder Show, let us know at jumpintucson.com. This is Tucson's only live local news talk station, KVOI, and you've been listening to Jump in Tucson.